New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing two guests, Karen Whitney Vernon and Jay Bennett. Karen is the CEO of millennial-focused digital agency Shift 2, a co-venture with leading production company Shaftesbury and its digital arm, Smoke Bomb Entertainment. Jay is the senior vice president of creative and innovation at Smoke Bomb Entertainment. Karn has a proven track record of creating successful millennial-targeted products, such as the popular lifestyle brand Verve Girl and TrendScan, the premier research study providing data on marketing to youth in Canada for more than 35 national and international brands. She was also the executive producer of The Avenue, the first reality show on YouTube, which garnered over 2.5 million collective views. Jay is an Emmy Award-winning leader in the global digital landscape who has created and produced numerous productions and applications with a distinct focus on blending storytelling with innovative technologies and social strategies. Together, they produce the popular YouTube series Carmilla, which is now in its third season and is redefining the concept of branded entertainment. Karen and Jay, thank you so much for joining us today. If we could start by giving me and the audience, some of whom might not be totally plugged in, to the elevator description of your show, Carmilla.
Carmilla is based on the original vampire novella written a decade or two before Bram Stoker's Dracula. But we have modernized it and updated it. We call it Buffy 2016. So it's a lighter-hearted take on the original novella, but follows the same storyline. And essentially, it is about a young woman named Laura, bit of a bookworm, bit of a social outcast, who befriends a young woman named Carmilla. And in the novella, which is actually quite creepy and scary, Carmilla slowly starts draining Laura of blood every night they sleep. And Laura is really torn. Does she get rid of this friend, this one person who's befriended her, knowing that she is slowly killing her? And in the novella, Laura decides not to, and in the end dies. And sort of the cold end is we realize that Carmilla just then moves down the road to the next house, and it's been doing this for centuries. We take a much lighter-hearted, more adventure
aspect on that. So. That's a bit of a bummer, right?
Yeah, but that was like old gothic. That's a good old gothic horror.
It was
right
a cautionary tale, right?
Yeah.
Between two women falling in love. That was why that was created that way.
It'll kill you. Yeah. Okay.
Dangerous. And so we sort of have flipped that on its head and really try and have embraced a story that is empowered, which tells a story about how women, and we have a very strong, large female ensemble cast in the show, how they can come together to rid the worlds of evils. So this is a more sort of Joss Whedon version of that story. Lots of mystery, intrigue. Season one opens with the disappearance of Laura's roommate, and that roommate is replaced by this sort of creepy, odd, aloof character named Carmilla. And over season one, Laura goes on to realize that not only is her roommate a vampire, but that she's also fallen in love with her. Okay. And that's led to three seasons of action and adventure.
Fantastic. Now, so having a show based on a gothic vampire novella from the late 1800s isn't really your standard fare. How on earth did you select that property? I know you've when I've read interviews, you talk about not creating an audience, but finding an audience that already existed. How did you find this?
It really began with us wanting to, Lizzie Bennet Diaries had recently come out and been very successful, within the sort of digital landscape. And, at Smoke Bomb, we were very interested in taking a run at that. So that was sort of the seed of it. It was then sort of, well, what show do we make? On what do we base it off of? And led by Steph Wachnin, who's the lead producer on Carmilla and an employee here at Smoke Bomb. She set out on sort of this hunt, scouring social media. And one of the things we came across was the hashtag Carmilla. And it was still garnering this conversation. There was the book. There'd been a couple movies in like the 60s and the 80s. There was a failed TV show. But something, there were still hundreds of thousands of comments every year about Carmilla. It was still resonating in this way. That sort of led us to its awareness. And then I think we really went and started to ask ourselves, how can we take this source material and adapt it to today? A couple of these sort of audiences we were interested in going after were the vlog style format of storytelling, which is based off of sort of that Lizzie Bennett format. We were interested in what we'll call the Joss Whedon universe, sort of that empowered female, quippy, bantery voice, and going after the groups socially and on the internet that are really into that style. We really wanted to go after an empowered female, and obviously for many reasons that is an interesting niche and underserved market in the media landscape that's discussed socially. And then we were interested in embracing a story about what it means to be a lesbian in the year 2016, and we didn't want to tell another story, like a coming out story.
Now Jay, in an interview I read out that was conducted with the two of you, one of the other things that you said was one of your mantras is the power of the niche. And I thought that was really interesting because a lot of cable networks are actually in the process of eliminating their niche channels. John Martin, the CEO of Turner, recently said that there are too many channels on the cable box and he expects to see a winnowing of outlets. So that, does your belief dovetail with what's going on there? Is it because you're in the digital space? How do you reconcile these two ways of thinking?
That statement is great news for us because that means there's more audience for us to go after. Really, it is the difference between doing TV. TV does something very specific, and it is a type of content, and it communicates with an audience. We've heard this all before. It is obviously broadcast. Having myself come and done a lot of what I'll call TV on the internets, and that's trying to make television on digital platforms for digital audiences, I have myself lived and breathed the difficulty of doing that because people, and I speak very specifically now at this point, the YouTube platform, which we use to broadcast Carmilla and several other branded series we've done, people don't turn to YouTube to watch a TV show. They turn to that to watch a very specific, very, very, very specific piece of content that means something very specific to them. And beyond watch, that's what we type into Google. We type in very, very specific questions. And so when we go and think about the power of the niche, I would much rather have in digital terms, you know, you could have a million people's eyeballs drift across your content, or you could have 10,000 people love and cherish your content. And I believe the power of the niche, that 10,000 that love it, that talk about it, that share it, that make it their own, is so much more powerful in trying to build audience and build engagement digitally than just sort of something that is more broadcast format that has a bit for everyone. I don't think people look to the internet for something that has a bit for everyone. They look very specifically. And so that's where we want to be making content for.
Fantastic. That's really interesting. It echoes some of the comments we've heard from Tiago Pinto about music and strategy and how you can love music, but you can also listen to it, the two levels of engagement in the music industry. I think it's really resonates a lot with that. One of the things that you've also, I know, Karen, millennials and authenticity, and sort of millennials is really, you know, totally how to hit this population. Now, you have a sort of the longstanding cliche about authenticity. Is it a cliche, first of all, that millennials are distrustful of traditional advertising? They're resistant to traditional advertising. And so branded content is the answer to that authenticity issue. Is that, do you feel that that's true?
Well, I think when it comes to millennials, we talk a lot about it, that they are looking to brands to entertain them. They are not watching your traditional 30-second ads. They have figured out how to block them at every in every way. So it's not just necessarily the authenticity. It's how do you reach them? How do you engage them? And, you know, we found that with entertainment that can also lead to education is giving them something of value that they appreciate. And then they feel like I'm not just being sold to, and they're tired of, you know, like I think most of us, we're just tired of being always hit over the head all the time with selling something. So I think millennials are much more aware of that, and that's where their guard comes up.
Right. Well, it's absolutely true. We had run a survey, and 2/3 of millennials have ad blockers up. And so they're absolutely screening out those ads, certainly in the digital spaces, anywhere where they're streaming the content.
And haven't you noticed, Gabriella? I mean, that honestly, when I was at a conference probably a year ago, that number was much less. And so the speed of that, adoption of that type of ad blocking is just, it would be scary for me if I was in that business.
Well, what's interesting is it's the population. If you look at the whole population, the whole viewing population, the penetration isn't nearly that. But what I looked at when we surveyed is this is your future audience. And this is where this is the cutting, bleeding edge of change. This is where you need to be, and you need to anticipate it so that when it hits you, you won't have time. By the time the wave hits you, you won't have time. So you need to see what's coming and adopt strategies that counteract that. And certainly branded content is one way to go about that. How and when and to what degree do you embed the brand's message into the content? I did see the one sort of educational bit around the product, but at what point in the life cycle of the story did that happen?
So we waited a time before we introduced the brand, and it wasn't that we didn't tell the fans or the audience that there was a brand involved. Right from the very beginning through social, we told people that this great content that you love is coming from a brand, and there was an excitement that built around it. And it wasn't until episode 17 that we actually announced that there was a brand, the particular name of the brand. And there was, you know, people are always afraid of what the thought is going to be when a brand is involved, but you should have seen the results were amazing. The fans really appreciated the fact that there was a brand that was involved, that it was funding this great content that they loved. But it was mirroring more the brand values within the show. I mean, I think Jay described what the show was all about. And really, when we were looking for the partner, and when we were talking to you by Kotex, their brand stands for the same thing, about empowered females, about doing things in a different way. And
a bit dark, quirky personality.
Yeah, you know, they have a black box. Everyone else has a white box. They have colorful patterned products inside. I mean, they're trying to do things that are different. So I think not only was it the format that we chose, being branded entertainment, was different than most of their competitors, but I think also the way and the character and the fact that Carmilla and Laura now appear on a box of tampons felt very natural. Like, it just works.
I think that's really where we as a company draw the difference between branded content and branded entertainment. I've certainly sat on my fair share of I put in air quotations, you know, branded entertainment panels where our compatriots and other companies put up their content and show, you know, long form digital commercials that feature their product, their logo, their everything. And, you know, it is our belief that when going after the most sophisticated market in the history of all time, which is a millennial today, right. They know in like 2 seconds if they're trying to be sold to. And if you try and sell to them, they are out. Where we want to come into the marketplace is argue the value of entertainment. It is without a doubt that millennial consumers want to be entertained, obviously with the proliferation of content. And millennial consumers want brands to entertain them. And they are incredibly sophisticated. They know if the brand is around that. The brand can fit in around that content. Once you have an audience that loves a show, not only are they open to seeing more, but they actually embrace seeing more. And so when we go and we do that, the content around it, where we sort of go and have fun with the brand, we play a we played a game show. We did sort of a little docu-drama thing on Do Vampires Get Their Period? You'll see that the not only does the viewership translate equal, same number of people who watch an episode watch that, but the comments stay the same. And now you find an audience who are commenting on commercial product and content in terms of, oh, I love this character, oh, You by K rocks, oh, thanks You by K for making this show. We transcend the, hey, watch this 30-second spot, then we'll get back to making the show for you.
Right.
And that's philosophically how we're trying to show a difference.
Right. So a lot of popular viral branded content has a distinct social message. And I think like Procter & Gamble's Like a Girl campaign. How important do you believe the social messaging and the fact that this is, it's a bit edgy, it's a bit daring, it's a bit edgy. It isn't something that's, this population is underserved. How important was that to the success? And can all brands find something like this? Or is this really, you know, you have to be a special brand to be able to leverage it?
Okay, we're both going to answer that. I'll answer from the creative point of view. I think all brands are open to leveraging it. I think the hardest part is the brands being open to leveraging it. I think, you know, as you just said, that is the power of the niche. And I think the reason the broad stuff doesn't pick up is because it's just too broad. If you look at us working with the Royal Bank of Canada, which is probably one of the five largest companies in North America, like a multi-billion dollar company, we made a series for them called V Morgan is Dead, where we killed the protagonist in the first 6 seconds and told this really cool story about a young woman trying to get a second chance at life by helping people and therefore embracing the bank's messaging of we want to help people. With Tetley Tea wanting to go and show that they can compete with artisanal teas and be a bit more trying to go in and compete against sort of the micro niche David's Tea of the world, we created a very successful series called Mislabeled about a young woman in the fashion industry who is trying to change it from the inside and moving from, you know, Vogue magazine telling you what to wear to a social media account telling you what to wear. So when I start pulling out examples, I a lot of the times we do encounter someone going, oh, well, You by Kotex. Well, they were just, that was crazy. But I think if you start to show and talk to people about those types of examples and showing the other ways you can think about it, the role of branded entertainment in a company's sort of infrastructure today, obviously with all the data, and I'm sure you've done episodes on that, with the decrease in the 30-second spot, with ad blocking software, etc., the role of branded entertainment for any brand can truly start to transcend beyond simply trying to sell something and start to fulfill this role of telling an audience what a brand stands for and represents. And that can be pretty powerful.
Well, I mean, Gabrielle, it's still new for a lot of brands to be doing this type of content where they're not seeing their logo and their product shots right away. But what I like to say is you've spent millions and millions of dollars creating a brand, and that brand has a story, and we just need to uncover what that story is and how it connects to this, to a particular audience, the audience that you want to target. And this idea of 18 to 34, adults 18 to 34, it's dying. And I know agencies are very, you know, people don't like change. People want things to stay that same way because that's how we monitor and that's how we, you know, we can analyze things and we feel comfortable, and no one's going to fire us if we keep doing what we did before in most cases. So it is, I do look for the mavericks because, when we do speak on panels, brands will come up to my clients and say, oh my God, you're so brave. And I always look at this and go, we're not curing cancer. We're not going to the moon. I mean, we're changing things up slightly, but we're still telling the story. We're engaging an audience. And at the end of the day, based on what we've seen, we can prove that we can return an ROI for the brand. So right. Depending on what the ROI is and what's important to them, we just have to set that up at the front, what we're doing. And because a lot of brands still consider this is my big beef, they put it in that, you know, that you've heard that 70-20-10, hey, we've got 10% of our budget and we're going to fiddle around with this and see what happens. But really what we're saying is use this as part of your marketing plan. Like, review it in the same way, give it the same objectives and the same standards you would. And I bet you'll see the same return. But as I say, don't put baby in the corner. Like, don't shove us off in the corner and, you know, try this out as something that maybe you hide or it's not part of your regular marketing plan. It has to be included. And you have to give it the same dedication.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things is that I was wondering about was distribution affects engagement. And I had read that Kotex didn't spend any money on distribution or promotion. So how did you grow your fan base and how did you roll it out?
Well, that was a question of, I mean, again, to Jay's point, when he talked about finding already current fan bases, and really it was social and finding those fan bases and talking to them and creating an opportunity for them to engage with the content and listening to what they had to say. And if you look at what a lot of the fans did say about the show, it was the fact that the you know, the people on the social channels were responding to them, that they were engaged with them, that they
responding to them authentically.
Yes,
I think that's our big thing. Is there you know, for every episode we created of Carmilla, there's at least five pieces of organic original social content that goes around that, not to mention our social team here are fans of Carmilla as well. And so when that engagement happens, it's real engagement, not sort of brand engagement, like cool, thanks with an emoticon. We'll engage in a conversation. And it was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, for, you know, it still is today. But to get that going of 6 months, of every day, you know, everyone in the office trying to go out and bring 20 new fans to the show. I remember sort of those sort of rallies we'd hold every afternoon where we'd sit around and just go hunting for new eyeballs. But with time, right, that sort of built a momentum, and now there is something that is self-sustaining and growing. You know, there's no denying that I think marketing should play a role in these things. Just because we have had some success doing it this way, I don't think that means that's the way it should be done.
You mean you don't want to spend the rest of your career growing your next properties by hunting for fans?
Well, I do say, and I say realistically, you know, one in 10 on shows, you, as with anything on any medium, you sort of just, you strike a chord.
Right.
Other ones need some love. And we can certainly point to hundreds of successful shows and movies today that were helped with...
this application of love.
Yeah. So I think that's the thing also with reach as well. I mean, we have reached an incredibly passionate, rabid fandom for Carmilla. I love the stat. We've been seen in 196 of the 198 countries in the world. We exist in 14 languages, all of which have been translated by the fans.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty cool. But I still believe that we're sitting on 10% of the potential audience that we could reach with the show.
How did you separate the IP? Is this something that the brand owns, or do you license it to them?
No, it's actually, I mean, that's a really interesting question in a way that we're changing a little bit of that advertising model, where the advertiser comes in and says, okay, I own 100% of this content. What we're doing in the flip is that we're partnering on this. So we all have a vested interest in the property. So perfect example, the client takes a lot longer for them to kind of make decisions, as you can imagine. It's a big organization trying to move it from the next road. And we're fast because you have to be in this day and age. It's the speed. So when Jay was down at Comic-Con and he announced the movie, the brand is understanding now, okay, well, now we're moving to a movie. Oh my goodness. Okay, well, we got to send it through our 10 months of evaluation. Right. And hey, the movie's starting. Like, we've got the fans, everybody's on board. And so sometimes it's, you know, by us having a vested interest as well in the IP and owning it, we're going to make sure we're protecting it. It's our baby just as much as the brand. So And we push them along. The client always says to me, oh my God, you guys always push us. We love it because no, you know, not a lot of people do that to them. A lot of people just want the status quo. It's easy for me as an agency to say, yeah, let's just keep doing the same old. He said, you are always pushing us. You're always making us look like the global audience. How do you know, we're saying, why aren't we doing stuff in Brazil? It's the third largest market. The Brazilians love this show. This is a global brand. Let's do Brazil. And so they're like, oh, okay. Like, how do we figure that out? And so a lot of what, because we share the IP, we have a vested interest in making sure this is successful.
Right. And that example there of all the mantra, you know, nobody tweets about the next commercial ever in the history of time. This is the power of entertainment. Is it transcends a commercial. It is something that is global, which is universal, and which can drive not only a fandom around it and a love around it, but ROI. I mean, we have every time a season ends, thousands and thousands of photos flood our social channels of people filling their shopping carts full of You Buy Kotex saying, make me another season, I'll buy your product forever. That's pretty
fantastic. Tough. It's funny. Because you could argue that audience is built by demand. And just as you say, there isn't really, people don't usually say, ooh, I think I'm going to hunker down in this rainy, cold weekend and watch some commercials. You know, that's just, you know, not really what's going on. And millennials or anybody really, they don't necessarily want to hear a brand talk about a brand story in that sense. They're interested in story. They're interested in entertainment. And the brands that understand that they're competing in the story landscape, that that's where they need to be playing, I think have an advantage, certainly.
What was that quote, Karin, that we liked recently? I don't know who to attribute it to.
It's Scott Galloway from L2, who said,
The 30-second commercial is a tax on the technologically inept and the poor.
That's good.
And it's true. I mean, that idea, look, we used to hunker down on a rainy weekend to watch a movie on television, and these ads would play and it'd be like, oh, okay, fine, you know, because I want to watch the show. I don't need that anymore.
Right.
I could go and watch that movie five different ways. I don't need to watch this spot. And so the only people getting slammed with these 30-second spots pushing, you know, what can get bloodstains out of my shorts or grass stains or whatever, you know, are the people who don't have the technology to get around them or the monetary ability to buy around them.
Right. So what most excites you about the change and disruption we're seeing in our industry right now?
Well, for me, it's that small people like Shift 2 with the that just started 2.5 years ago can make an indent in this big world of advertising. And I think a lot of smaller companies can get out there and do just disruptive things. And the big companies just don't know what's going on.
Right, right.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm sort of in the same way. I mean, we have created this sort of little phenomenon of Carmilla. We're about, you know, we've just announced the feature. We're about to announce some more platforms. That was all done out of this office space at some desks in terms of the creative, the production, the audience engagement, the distribution. I think, you know, the hope is as we continue to tell this story, we can bring more sort of, in Karin's term, more mavericks over to our side and to continue to try and tell really cool stories with brands.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the show and talking with me. I really appreciate it. Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few people who have helped to bring the program to life. First, the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thank you. Our production team over Microfame Media, a big thank you to our guests and new friends, Karin and Jay. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.